You're listening to ESBO International's School Business Insider. I'm your host, John Brucato. Each week on School Business Insider, I sit down with school business officials and industry experts from around the world to share their stories and explore the topics that matter most to you. Find out what it means to be a school business official and get your insider pass on all things school business. Hello, and welcome back to School Business Insider. Today, I have the privilege of speaking with Stephen Morales, Chief Executive of the Institute of School Business Leadership in the UK. Stephen is a visionary leader dedicated to revolutionizing the landscape of education by bringing the principles of operational excellence to the forefront. Traditionally associated with manufacturing, IT, healthcare, and construction, operational excellence is a concept that prioritizes efficiency, innovation, and continuous improvement. Stephen, however, is on a mission to bridge the gap between the private and public sectors by exploring and applying the principles of operational excellence in the world of education. Join us as I dive into the fascinating discussion, exploring the challenges and opportunities of implementing operational excellence in public education. From streamlining administrative processes to maximizing resources, Stephen will share his insights and strategies for driving positive change and enhancing the educational experience for students, educators, and communities alike. Stephen, welcome to the podcast. I'm happy to have you.
Hi, John. Great to be here.
Yeah, and great to have you back on. You're a two-time contributor to School Business Insider, so I appreciate you taking the time to sit down with me yet again. But before we get into really the concept of operational excellence and how it correlates to public education, can you just give our listeners just a little bit of your background?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, John. So, I've been in education now since 2003, so that's 21 years in one capacity or another, in schools, managing finances and operations. I started my career in Spain, managing the finances of a group of international schools, and I did some work with University of La Laguna in Tenerife in Spain, as well as work with the international school. And I came back to the UK 2007 and did a stint in a high profile school just outside of London. And I started to get involved in some policy work with officials at the Department for Education. And I guess that was the route into me thinking more deeply about the system as a whole rather than an isolated or an independent kind of establishment. I was thinking more broadly about how can we make improvements across the system and what contribution can people from industry make to improving schools. And I think it's fair, John, to say that I've spent my 21 career years in education trying to find the right language so that I don't alienate educators.
Yes.
And there's been pushback throughout my whole career when I use language which leads people to believe that I'm about profit and about the bottom line and efficiency for efficiency's sake. And absolutely, that is not the case. It's the opposite. The most important thing about our work is how we improve the life chances of the children that we serve. The Institute itself, just a little bit on that, I've been the chief executive now for just over 10 years. And we started as an association. So if you like, a big part of what we were doing was representing the profession, advocating on behalf of our members. And we've shifted, we've moved from an association to becoming a national institute and institute status in the United Kingdom is something that's hard fought and quite precious. We're very privileged to be given that status, but we are moving into that territory of setting expectations, professional standards. We are a professional body now, and doing less in the kind of voice of the profession space. Not that we don't care about that. We absolutely do. We deeply care, and we continue to be the conduits between policy and practice. But our work is has moved certainly since 2015 from one where we were, if you like, the voice of communities of school business leaders to setting expectations through, for example, professional standards and accreditation pathways and working closely with providers of formal qualifications. And OPEX, if you like, is the next chapter in our existence where we're setting clear expectations of excellence using evidence, global evidence actually, about what effectiveness, what are the ingredients that you see in really well-run, efficient, purposeful establishments.
That's great. And I have a couple follow-up questions. You just hit me with a lot of really cool information. First, you mentioned you have been in public education for 21 years in multiple countries. How has having the opportunity to work in multiple countries changed your mindset on how to approach education effectively?
No, so it's a really good question. And just again, by way of context, my travels have taken me beyond Europe. I did some really interesting work in the Middle East, in state education in the Kingdom of Saudi. Wow. That was fascinating. I've spent time at Deakin University in Melbourne, looking at their approach to developing school business leadership, and of course I've had long and ongoing conversations with colleagues at Adwoa International and colleagues in Canada. That there's lots of things that are similar, and probably more things that are similar than there are that are different. But there are some nuances. There's some important nuances, and I think one of the most fundamental things is the extent to which schools or groups of schools have autonomy, and the regulatory environment in which they work. So if everything is prescribed, there's very little latitude to move one way or another. If there's lots of freedom, that comes with its own challenges. I mean, I think educators welcome the space to innovate and to shape their thinking and their ideas without the constraints of, you know, the unreasonable constraints of policy diktats. But if you open things up too much, what you end up is the kind of Wild West, and right. And then you worry about consistency. And what I, you know, in our mixed economy, what we see is schools and groups of schools called trusts in the UK, some doing wonderful things. And that's not necessarily related to size. It can be, you know, it can be a single school doing brilliant things with limited resources. And you can see a massive organization with, you know, dozens of schools that are failing some of their pupils, so I'm not convinced we've got the evidence yet to say what's the right way to do it.
My question was going to be: maybe anecdotally for this conversation, are you seeing a correlation between local control and more government control, and the correlation between that and maybe the success of schools and students? I mean, are you seeing that if a school has more local control and more creative freedom, you're seeing greater success rates in with students, or is it the opposite, or is it kind of hard to say?
It's difficult to say. What I would say is that if you look at a lot of the Scandinavian systems where teachers are paid very well, they're respected as true professionals, so they're paid commensurate with a lawyer or a doctor or somebody similar, and they are given quite a lot of freedom, and the outcomes are very positive. Now, there's some caveats to that, because the cohort of children they're teaching, the standard of living means that it's easier to get good outcomes. There aren't necessarily the same kind of social challenges that we face and that you face in the US. So freedom is good. We have a system which is contradictory. So we've given freedom to something called Academy Trust. So basically we've said we'll detach multi-academy trusts, which is groups of schools, a bit like districts, from the local politics, and there'll be a direct line between the trust and government. And you can basically do what you want. You can structure your team how you think is best, and you can pay your leaders what you think is the right level. So budget's your budget, we'll judge you on outcomes. But there's a really heavy accountability framework, and that accountability framework is so onerous, if you like. So there's freedom, but not freedom without a big price. And right. So we'll give you all this freedom, but we expect these outcomes. And if you don't achieve those outcomes, then we're going to be all over you. So whether that's financial sustainability or pupil outcomes. So what we end up with is a culture where we're chasing a kind of set of metrics.
Kind of teaching to the test almost, not really.
In every sense. Yeah. So teaching to the test, but also using resources efficiently, not because it's the right thing to do for the community of learners, but it's about balancing the books.
Yeah, and almost a preservation of status. Like we are this institution that has this autonomy, but it comes with such a heavy price that is it worth maybe having that autonomy if you have to focus so much on these metrics that, you know, is there a great benefit to students? Yeah, I don't know.
And therein lies the conundrum. And as I say, if you look across our system, some trusts seem to have got that balance right. However, they've achieved it. Others not so much. And we are very reliant in our system on charismatic leaders. So a charismatic chief executive, which I guess would be an equivalent to a superintendent, a very strong CFO, and a very capable and professionally diverse board of trustees.
Sure.
Now, if you take any one of those ingredients away, suddenly that organization becomes very vulnerable. If you take all of them away and replace them with a different group of people, I'm not convinced that you're going to get the same outcomes. And that's why setting an expectation in terms of operational excellence and creating those ingredients, so no matter who the leadership team is, it's you're following the same blueprint, and therefore you should end up with similar outcomes.
Right. So the framework should really be agnostic of the leader. I mean, of course, you want visionaries and strong leadership, you know, pushing our educational institutions forward. But to your point, if you have the right systems in place, you should be able to plug almost anybody in to follow that blueprint, right?
Correct. And again, just a bit of a caveat there. So I'm not diminishing the importance of great leaders. I mean,
of course not.
Great leaders have, probably the most important thing they have is emotional intelligence, and they know how to unleash the potential of their teams. That's absolutely right. But what we do want to avoid is kind of maverick leadership or leadership which is ego driven or based on self interest. So we end up all over the place and it's a bit chaotic. And I think what OpEx is trying to do is anchor leadership, not stifle it, and not diminish the value of leaders who absolutely are inspirational and visionary. But anchor them, if you like.
So for those not familiar with operational excellence, can you just provide an overview of what operational excellence, or OpEx as we're referring to it on this podcast today, is, and really kind of frame it in the context of public education and why you feel it's so important?
Yeah, of course. And John, you did a really good job of introducing OpEx and talking about how it's been embedded in industry for quite some time. It has evolved and I think matured from the early days where, you know, I think motor manufacturing in Japan was where it was born. It's more nuanced than that now. But ultimately, as I was saying before, it's about the ingredients to operational success. There are 13 domains. I won't go through every domain, but amongst them, some really important areas that we'll explore. The first thing to say is that the quality of teaching is the most important thing that we're trying to achieve. And for the purposes of this piece of research and the blueprint that we're trying to develop, the customer is the teacher. So we're trying to make sure that the resources land with the teacher, so the right resources, the right time, and without any bureaucratic delays.
That's interesting, because a lot of the times when we're functioning in our capacities, the customer is the student, right? So we're looking to grow our young learners. But so with this operational excellence, this is really focusing on internal controls and processes, and, you know, the customer being the teacher, really that's the mechanism delivering quality education. So we're building those processes around that.
Correct. And to be clear, so the ultimate customer is the student.
Right.
You could possibly add the parent and the student, but ultimately it's the student. So what we're trying to do is provide the teacher, whose customer is the pupil,
right,
with everything they need to do the best job, so they can be the best version of themselves as teachers, and therefore ensure optimum outcomes for children. That's the holy grail, if you like, of what we're trying to do. So amongst the things that we will look closely at are our culture. That's really important. I think there's a saying, isn't there? Culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Yep.
I think that's absolutely right. If you don't have a culture that everyone buys into, if we're not all moving in the same direction, ultimately, if we're not clear about the end state, then that creates resistance. And when you talk about operational excellence, it's all about flow. We want everything moving in the same
right.
direction, and sometimes it'll move really quickly, and sometimes it'll move a little bit more slowly. But the important thing that it's flowing continuously in a forward direction.
Yeah, and in my research of OpEx, culture really was the common thread amongst all the definitions and explanations of what it is and how it's effectively implemented. And it just kind of makes sense, because if it's inherent in your culture, it's just baked into what you're doing every single day. So it's not just another thing you have to worry about. It just becomes the fabric of your organization and how you move forward.
Correct. No, absolutely. So culture is we pay a lot of attention to that, and we will, you know, through our research, we'll be asking, you know, some probing questions of the most senior people in the organization, but we'll take that and compare and contrast it with very junior members of staff, people that make an important contribution that maybe don't have not highly qualified, haven't had the privilege of a degree education, but they're still important. They're important cogs in the machine. And if they're telling us something different in terms of the culture of the organization from the chief executives, who've got, you know, got this very, very polished script on, you know why we're doing what we're doing, if that doesn't resonate with the person who is, you know, the caretaker or the cleaner or the cook or whatever it is, if it doesn't resonate, then the culture message isn't working, isn't getting through. And the same at middle management. So if middle management are, and this is actually quite dangerous but quite common, is that you get lip service to senior people. So middle management saying, yeah, we really buy into that culture and we're on board. And they turn around and they say, no, we have a completely different view of the world, and this is all madness. And you know, senior leaders are moving too fast, and they just want to change everything every 5 minutes. And if you've created a situation where there isn't commitment and buy-in, like genuine commitment and buy-in in the middle of your organization, you're going to have a problem all the way through it. So that's one thing that we look very closely at. The other thing, and I think it's important to make a distinction between human performance and performance management. They're two very separate things. So performance management would be a conversation with a colleague, with a member of staff about the understanding about the contribution they're going to make to whatever your objectives are as an organization. And their set of objectives feed into the wider objectives of the organization, and you agree those, and you monitor and measure them over a period of time, and hopefully you come back to the conversation and you seek a view from the member of staff about how they're performing, and then you offer some feedback in terms of your perception, and you reach consensus on a on a way forward. That's performance management. And somewhere in there, there's the investment that you're making to their improvement, which is absolutely important. And I worry enormously if I see organizations that believe that that there should be other priorities for spend. I think investing in people's capability continuously is essential to the success of any organization.
And are you, when you talk about implementing operational excellence in an educational institution, is this just kind of a direct hierarchy on the educational administrative side of the organization? Or when you're approaching this and wanting to make this successful in the UK, are you also factoring in the operational side of the house? So feeding children, transporting children, technology. Is this a organizational-wide initiative?
Yeah, it is. We should be clear that we're not straying into pedagogy. So we're not straying into what happens in the classroom, mm-hmm. and the approach to differentiation. We're not in the pedagogical school improvement space. That's not our wheelhouse. Yeah. And that's not our level of expertise. There is a place for that, and there are some interesting pieces of work going on, both in the UK and globally, in terms of how you ensure consistency and how you the ingredients, but that's not the focus of this, but it does absolutely stray into those ancillary services. So catering would be one, transport would be another, the school environment really, really important. So right. Yeah, we will absolutely go there. But just back on the human performance versus performance management. So performance management is, as I've described, human performance is when you look at your organization, you will have people with different intrinsic motivators. People will have different levels of aptitude. You're going to have some really bright, talented people who just grasp things in an instant and they can just run with it. Others that take a little bit longer. Sometimes the people who take a bit longer are actually more committed to the organization. Some that are really bright may lack motivation. So when you identify any headroom in people's capability, the question we should be asking is, how are you helping those that are struggling? So how are you, right. You're very talented, you're very capable, how are you supporting the person next to you who's struggling a little bit? And how do we make sure that levels of motivation, levels of commitment are consistent throughout the organization? So we end up with high levels of productivity, people playing to their strengths, but giving every ounce of their energy to the task, and they don't see unreasonable fluctuations.
Well, it sounds like you're building a culture where your success is my success, right? You're correct. Bolstering up your colleagues to all be high functioning individuals, but I think capitalizing on the human performance, as you said, to unique needs. So, you know, everybody is kind of a cog in that wheel, but everybody isn't doing the exact same thing. There are different skill sets that you can maximize. And like you said, if somebody is on a different skill set or a different level, that doesn't mean they're any less or more important in the organization. They just have a very unique role to fill, but you're still relying on them to be successful. So you, in turn, are successful, and most importantly, the organization is high functioning.
Absolutely. And that's where we want to get to in terms of the overall culture. We look at tech as part of this, and there are three verticals in that tech space. One of them is systems. So that's the tool that we use to capture data. Then there's data itself, and what we do with that data really matters. How we disseminate. How we make the information that we're providing to stakeholders digestible, and then the so what question. So you produce data, you end up with a dashboard. What are we going to do with it, guys? Where are we going with it? What does it mean? And so forth. And then there's a third vertical, which is it's new. It's coming at us like a freight train. And that's AI. Where does AI sit in the tech space? I think there's early signs of AI being used to, if you like, bridge the gap between data and reporting. Sorry, systems and reporting. Mm-hmm. So using AI to extract data, put it into a format that is digestible for stakeholders, maybe even taking data from one system to another without manual intervention. There's some early signs of some low hanging fruit and some quick wins. But we'll explore that in a bit more depth, and we're bringing in some experts in this field who will have a view on what we can expect over the next 5 years. But this is new, and I can't say a great deal more.
Yeah. So before I get more into the what, can we kind of widen the lens a little bit and talk about the why? Sure. What inspired you to really take this on and introduce operational excellence into the public sector? Because we talked about it being in manufacturing, we're talking about IT. There's a lot that goes into operational excellence, and it's been proven successful in many private sector industries. But what was kind of the inspiration for you to introduce this into education?
It's a really good question. So I guess when you've been exposed to different environments, and so listeners are aware, I started my career managing leisure facilities. Then I got quite heavily into change management and quality assurance. They were two sides of the same coin, if you like. I guess I did a reasonable job with one of the districts in the south of England, and I was invited to join Credit Suisse and join their change management team. And it was quite a jump, quite a leap to move from public sector into banking. I saw the good and bad of investment banking, but I was in a position where resources were plentiful, and the latest innovation was there for us to play with. And there's some really good takeaways from that experience. And my whole career since I moved out of investment banking and into education, I've been thinking there is so much that I've learned in other sectors that could be applied to education. But the pushback has always been, Stephen, you're not a teacher, so you're not a teacher, you don't understand.
Yeah.
Great, thank you very much. You're helping us with our mission, and you're certainly taking workload away from us. And that's the kind of narrative, really. In fact, there was a strap line a few years ago back in the National College days, and it was went something like, school business professionals save head teachers 30% of their time, which may be the case, but I would contest that.
We can do a little more than that, but
a little more than that. And also, I would say that the time that the teachers who were only tenured teachers were spending trying to work their way through finances, it was 30% of wasted time because they didn't have the expertise. So it's not that the head teachers could do the job if they had the time; they didn't have the time, and they can't do it anyway. And that's the difference. So we're bringing a very unique set of skills to the table, and I have, again, for a long time advocated that school business leadership is way more than a compliance function. It's not just about, because I think you can be a compliant organization and actually quite a bad one.
Yeah.
Now that isn't to say that we need to be reckless, but if you're defining yourself just by compliance, then I think you've missed the point. And so the reason I'm passionate about firstly professional standards, but now OPEX, is that I believe that with the right ingredients, we can use our resources far more effectively, and therefore we can affect more people's lives in a very positive way. If we're using leadership time and technology and our resources inefficiently or suboptimally, the ripple effect will be that children's learning experience is less than it could be. So by embarking on a project which sets clear expectations, but also sets out the ingredients for excellence, and we deploy leaders appropriately, we play to people's strengths, that we get talented people doing the things that they are best at and not the things that they're not very good at, and we can equip teachers to do the best job in front of a child, then that has to be a great outcome. And that's what drives me.
So education isn't always welcome to change, and this is sounding like a very lofty but very powerful goal of yours. What are some of the key challenges and barriers you see to really effectively implementing OpEx into education? And how do you think you'll be able to overcome those?
Again, really great question. So the first thing in any kind of improvement journey is recognizing that there is an improvement to be had.
Yeah.
So if you think say you're a runner or you go to the gym and you think there is no improvement to be had, then you're not going to embark on an incremental program of improvement. So I think the first thing is to pause, reflect, and say, can we do better than we're doing currently? I think that's the first challenge.
Well, it sounds like you're assuming a lot of vulnerability there with those that you're working with, right? We talk a lot about that at the leadership conference, and especially those in leadership, whether it be a superintendent or CEO or CFO, I think the higher you get in the organization, a lot of the times that vulnerability shrinks because you don't want to be seen as weak or ineffective. But I think vulnerability is going to be an important piece of operating or operational excellence, because everything you just mentioned, I think, just kind of assumes that people are willing to admit that there is room for improvement, right?
Absolutely. And it isn't about saying what's gone before is rubbish.
Right.
You're inadequate or deficient as a leader. It isn't about that at all. It's about recognizing there are improvements that can be made. And what happens in our system, I'm sure it's the same in the US, is that when we talk about change, what people will say is there is no headroom for change. There's no, because we're firefighting, we're just about treading water, and policy has done this to us. So the lack of funding into education, the lack of headspace to think, the overbearing accountability framework, these are all reasons to kind of not do things differently, because there is no room mentally, emotionally, or anywhere, any other kind of way that this can happen. So I think we have to give the system space to think and pause, and I think there needs to be a recalibration of the accountability regime. There is a piece of work going on again in our system called simplification, and the idea is that we reduce wherever possible bureaucratic burdens. The trouble is that I don't think we've gone far enough with it, because we've gone for the low hanging fruit. So a guidance document from government might be 200 page document, and so they cut the word count to 100 words. But if the requirements are still there behind the word count, then you haven't really achieved much in terms of simplification. So meaningful simplification means agencies, regulators being courageous, as well as the system being courageous and responsible, and saying, yes, we're going to let go in some areas so that you can innovate and you can move ahead. But once we strip all that back, and we give people space, I wonder then whether, I still think there'll be a reluctance to be vulnerable and say, I can improve. I'm not the finished article, and I'm actually excited about the improvement journey that I can go on. I mean, I find it baffling, because it's a bit of a cliche, but every day is a learning day for me. And that's the moment I'm not excited about being a better version of myself, is the moment that I should stop doing all this.
And how do you effectively introduce this as just not another thing? Because as you were saying, school districts and school systems alike receive so many mandates, whether they be funded or unfunded. And it, like you said, we're oftentimes treading water and just trying to put fires out day to day. How do you introduce this where it's accepted and people can find the bandwidth in a system that is so constrained by policy and oftentimes governmental overreach?
Yeah. So our approach, I mean, and the first thing to say is that we'll do this piece of research, and it's certainly not, we do the research, we create a blueprint, and that's it. And
you know, right.
This is the start of a conversation. It's going to be incremental. And I'm sure people are going to challenge some of the recommendations and the findings and say, well, you could do this, or you could refine that, or you went too hard there, or you didn't go hard enough over here. That's fine. I'm comfortable with that. But what I hope people do is look at what we're saying and say, this is a moment for me to reflect, for leaders to reflect on where they are in terms of their approach to operations. And there's a journey that they can embark on at a pace that works for them. So no one's holding a gun to anybody's head. No one's saying, you know, we're going to start assessing you, and there's going to be serious consequences if you don't reach these sets of targets within a given time. I don't think it's about that at all. I think it's about understanding what the ingredients are and saying, where am I in terms of this set of ingredients? Where are we as an organization? And how do we take incremental steps towards improvement at a pace that's right for us all, which is sensible and mature? How fast we get to whatever the promised land is, there are all sorts of factors, and part of that will be the extent to which our policymakers want to get behind it, fund it, encourage it, give space. The extent to which this becomes part of leadership career pathway, so how baked into curriculum will it be or not? And then, you know, of course, at the end of it all, the extent to which we can demonstrate impact. So we can, you know, we can do something, we can announce it, we can launch it, we can encourage the system to go on that journey. In a year, 18 months, 2 years, what we'll have to do is a piece of evaluation where we say those that have taken the recommendation seriously and started to implement some of that stuff, these are the outcomes, and this is the difference. And I guess that's the most powerful thing. So once we can start to show evidence that this actually leads to improvement and ultimately improved outcomes for children, then people will start to pay attention.
So when we look at the what now, you mentioned data is a really important piece of assessing and implementing operational excellence. What kind of data are you looking at, and how are you assessing it? When we talk about culture, you know, I feel it is often difficult to quantify culture. It is such an anecdotal experience and just something you experience day to day, but to quantify it, I think, can be challenging. So with that, what other data points are you looking at, and how are you using that data to assess if operational excellence is actually being implemented effectively? And more importantly, is there buy-in throughout the organization?
So the way that organizations use data tells us a lot, I think, about the organization itself.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, if you have a presentation in front of key stakeholders, education board or whatever the environment might be, and you have your superintendent or your chief finance officer throw up a dashboard, and the dashboard has kind of a RAG rating, green, amber, red, and broadly things are where they should be, lots of green and a little bit of red and a bit of amber. What is the conversation that follows the data being thrown up there? So does the data go up and everybody just nods and goes, okay, next slide, please, next agenda item, or is there a proper conversation about what any of the numbers mean? So even when the numbers are good, what does that actually mean? So we're great, we're around the best fit line, and we're doing everything that's expected of us. So what? So what are we doing with that? Does that mean we're now going to coast? Does it mean we're going to push on and really stretch the organization and the individuals within it and ultimately pupil outcomes? Or are we going to go, yeah, that's great, we all feel warm and cozy about things and we, you know, just carry on? And conversely, if the data tells us that there are some very big problems, lots of red and amber, what we normally get, again, this is a very broad brush, but we normally get in an environment where it's executive team and stakeholders, board members, you get lots of defensiveness from the executive where the numbers are not where they're supposed to be. So lots of excuses really about why the numbers
are. Yeah, it's easy when the data is good, right? But when the data is bad, it's like, I don't want to talk about it.
So when the data looks terrible and ugly, what you get is all sorts of, yeah, but, you know, the yeah buts and the
finger pointing and the excuses. And,
yeah, my context is different and we could have done this, but we didn't do it because of X, Y, Z. And anyway, it's all about the politicians making life impossible for us and so on and so forth. But what we don't do, on the other side of that, what we get is the directors and board members kind of tapping the desk going, if we see these numbers like this again next time we meet, there'll be hell to play. There'll be consequences.
Right.
We can't have that again. And the consequences are never actually articulated. Just there will be consequences. So you create a culture which is not helpful at all to anybody. And what we should be saying is, where the data is looking good, what are we going to do next, and how are we going to push on from there? And that's a great foundation for further improvement. And if the data is looking bad, what is it we need to do differently to shift the tide? What are the steps that together, both executives and non-executives, are going to do to make those numbers look good the next time? And where are the pinch points? What's wrong? Is it the pressure that the teacher's under? Is it the lack of resources? Is it because we prioritise our spending incorrectly? Is there a productive conversation coming out of that data set? Or are we just throwing the data up, people are taking sides, and there's this tension which isn't productive? So again, through the OPEX lens, the way that data is used to move forward is what matters.
And it sounds like with the OPEX model, it's stripping away any possibility or a lot of possibility of surprises, because you know from the get-go, if the data is good, then this. If the data is mediocre, then we go this way. If the data is bad, we're going to head down another path. So you kind of already know where you're headed before you get the data. And that probably, I would assume, would lower some angst in the organization if you kind of already know what to expect, rather than dealing with a board who's reactionary and kind of threatening consequence if things aren't to go so well.
Correct. And again, that's a culture thing, isn't it? So we create, we're creating an environment where we're open and transparent, that we share stuff early, that we're proactive rather than reactive. And again, a bit of a cliche, but it's right. And we use the data as the pulse, really. The data in and of itself is just a snapshot, and it's what we do with it next. It's the so what afterwards that matters. I mean, the other thing to say, John, is that I see time and time again board environments where there is so much information and so much data that you're blinded. There is so much information that you're more confused when you walk out of the room than you were when you stepped into it.
Right.
So it's important to be able to distill the information so the really important messages are coming through, and the areas where we need to do something different are identified. Not this kind of overload of stuff that it's difficult to engage with.
So we've talked a lot about the theoreticals and the why, but let's talk a little bit about how. So how are you in the Institute of School Business Leadership going to approach this? What is your roadmap to potentially implement OPEX, maybe in your own organization, and then have that transcend throughout school systems in your country?
Yeah. So again, another excellent question. So, I mean, we we should live and breathe the values of operational excellence within our organization, and we'll start to do that. But our focus is more externally facing than it is internally facing. The way that we get traction with this is that we get some energy around the get some energy and some interest around the subject, and we've worked really carefully to develop an advisory board, which includes very senior government officials, some respected academics, ASBO's chief executive Jim Ryan is on the board. Professor Karen Starr from Deakin University in Australia sits on the board, and then we've got a number of influential sector bodies from the UK also presiding over the advisory board. Now, that's important because bringing those stakeholders together, deeply immersed in what we're doing, means that we can get the message out to a much wider audience. And it will give them early opportunity to say, the direction of travel of the research is slightly off, needs recalibrating, the emphasis needs to be here rather than here. And the other thing is that, because we've got that kind of transatlantic comparison going on, so we'll be talking to a sample of districts in the US, small and large, as well as our own sample, we're going to get some international conversation going, and I think that's the way that we get some proper enthusiasm for this. I should have said that we've also got the University of Manchester involved in the project, which, it's a reputable, it's a reputable university, university that spent a lot of time researching and deeply interested in our education system. So there's a wealth of academic research that will underpin some of our thinking.
So I don't want to ask what the end goal is, because I think this is an ever-evolving process, and it's just something that you'll be working on just kind of in perpetuity. But is it too early to identify some milestones in terms of identifying success in this this venture?
I think we can. I think we can, and we've already got interest.
I mean, the fact that you have interest worldwide, I think, is a huge milestone, right?
It really is. And so there isn't a single presentation that I've delivered, and I've delivered many over the last 3 or 4 months on this subject. There isn't a single presentation where people haven't been really curious about what we're doing. Now, I'm not saying they are fully signed up to changing their entire approach, but people haven't come to me and said, "I reject this. This is ridiculous. What are you trying to do?" They've said, "I'm fascinated by how this can help me in my organization. I'm fascinated to see what next, and I'm really interested to see what comes out of the research." And I think that fascination is born out of, interestingly, a desire to be a better version of themselves, or help their organization be a better version of itself. So whilst we talked a little bit about how can we win hearts and minds earlier in the podcast, I think there are some green shoots in terms of leaders being at least curious about what we're doing, and therefore prepared to experiment, if you like, with an early approach to adopting OpEx. Sure. What I think in terms of milestones, what would be great is if we could revisit operational excellence in 6 months or a year's time, and some of those early adopters tell us what they've done and the impact that it's had. So that would be fantastic if we ended up with a sample of 20, 30 multi-academy trusts and a similar number of districts that could actually provide very tangible evidence of an improvement as a consequence of what we're doing. That's the first milestone. And I think, as ever, it's a kind of plan, do, review cycle, isn't it? So. Once we get to that review stage, we'll think again, and then we go back on the loop again. And just like everything else, it's a continuous improvement loop. So, yeah, I think if that answers the question, I think the
yeah, absolutely, market, absolutely. And I know you're early on in the process, so I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No. It's good.
So when you look at operational excellence, it's obviously an organization-wide effort, but can you tell me where you see the school business official fitting in specifically to implementing this and ensuring its continued success?
Absolutely central. So, I mean, you would think that the heavy lifting in creating the conditions for operational excellence to thrive would be absolutely within the remit of the school business official. I think the caveat to that is that they will need significant backing from chief executives of multi-academy trusts and superintendents in districts, and possibly the board as well, whatever governance structure applies to whatever jurisdiction we're talking about. But this is, if you take this outside of education, who's likely to be across this stuff? I think you'd be looking at the chief operating officer of a medium to large size organisation. Chief finance officer would take a deep interest, and then there'll be people who'll be there'll be intersection with specialist areas like human resources or infrastructure and technology, or estates management. But the coordinator, if you like, the convener of all of this stuff, school business official, 100%.
Yeah. So what advice would you give a school business official if they would like to kind of explore the topic of operational excellence a little further and maybe look at it as an opportunity for their school district or their system and organization?
So I think the first thing to say is, well, there's literature out there on the principles of operational excellence. So you can have a look at that. And actually, when you look at the overarching principles, they are applicable. They should make sense. But specifically for education, what I would say is pay attention to this conversation, which I hope we continue to have.
Absolutely.
I want to make the early findings accessible to the entire school business official community in the US. No doubt we'll do that through the various channels. And I think Jim's, as the chief executive, is fully signed up to that. And likewise, I want to make sure that we share perspectives as well, so that we share the US and the UK perspective with each other's respective audiences. So we're not just looking at operational excellence in the UK if we're a UK practitioner. We're looking at what are the insights from what's happening in the US and vice versa. And as I said before, I suspect what we'll see is pockets of excellence already in play.
Right.
Even though it isn't necessarily under the formal banner of operational excellence. And therefore, we should shine a spotlight on that.
That's a great point. I mean, with a big initiative like this, oftentimes people can get wrapped around the axle of thinking that we need to throw out everything we have, our playbook is no good. But you just made an excellent point. If you're doing something well, capitalize on that and fold that into the overall implementation of operational excellence.
100%. And not only capitalize on it, but share it.
Right.
So, I mean, that actually is, if you think about the evolution of any system, how do we grow organically? It's by sharing. If there's great stuff going on and it completely responds to whatever expectation we have of a particular domain, then we should be all over it, and we should be sharing, and we should be making sure that everyone's cited on that great work. And then we build as a system. We build on that.
Well, speaking of sharing, it sounds like you have a great presentation you could do at ASBO International's AC&E conference in September. Is that something you've considered?
I would love to. I'd be delighted, John. If that works and your program design people want me there, I'd be delighted.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really inspiring topic. And Again, I think it's going to be a delicate balance moving forward because, as you had mentioned before, educational organizations are oftentimes inundated with mandates from government and constantly having to do more with less. But this is something I think that could pay dividends down the road if it's implemented correctly and there's buy-in and there's culture behind it.
That's great. I mean, I'm really pleased that that you share my enthusiasm.
Yeah, yeah. So before we sign off here, let's shed a little bit of light on the Institute of School Business Leadership. You have your national conference coming up in November. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that conference and what kind of gets you excited about it?
Yeah, no, thank you. So we have our showcase event is in November, and we have
28th and 29th.
That's it. There you go. We run our event in Birmingham. Birmingham is a big city. It's becoming a kind of hub for these kind of things. Lots of thought leadership takes place in Birmingham because it's central. The atmosphere is always always fantastic. I think similar to your event. It is the coming together of like-minded professionals that are really interested in the experiences of their colleagues, but also I think get great kind of comfort and almost therapy by sharing some of the big challenges that they face. And the school business official role can be quite isolating or sure. Isolated. So to be able to bounce off of colleagues is really important. So there is a networking and social element, which is really, really important. But beyond that, we try to balance three things, really. So there is an experience element to it. So we're coming together. There's a fun and social aspect to it. We try to bring non-education inspirational speakers to the event, so we get new perspectives and we get to hear about amazing stories from individuals who've done remarkable things against all odds, often, you know, facing ridiculous adversity. But we also listen to subject matter experts and people who understand education intimately in all of the various strands. So we'll have policy experts, we'll have people who understand education law, we'll have people who can talk deeply and confidently about funding, about the assurance framework. So I think the combination of a really good networking event, fun with colleagues, time away from school to think and reflect, inspirational speakers, and then people who really know in detail the depth of the various things that we need to pay attention to. I think that combination makes it very special. And it's lovely because we always have an international flavour, and I know ASBO International have been strong supporters, so we really enjoy welcoming the chief executive, president, and often the COO. So and you know, long may that continue.
I was going to ask. I mean, it sounds like it's not limited to just the UK educational professionals. So I'm looking at your registration site right now. I'm a little intrigued, and you know, I've never been to Birmingham, so maybe I can hop across the pond this year.
Well, come along. We'd love to have you. It'd be amazing.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, Stephen, this has been an incredible conversation. And I think the area of operational excellence is something that, although prevalent in the private sector, is something that we might be missing out on opportunity if we don't seriously look at in the public sector in education. And hopefully we can see this kind of transcend throughout education worldwide. And you know, I commend you on all the work you're doing and really taking this initiative on. It's not going to be an easy lift, but I know you're the right man for the job, and you're already assembling a great team based on the feedback that you've given today on this podcast. So, Stephen, thank you again for joining me, and I look forward to your continued success in the future.
John, thank you. It's been a privilege. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to School Business Insider. Make sure to check back each week for your favorite topics on school business.